This is a CBC podcast.
The marketing world is shifting from the age of persuasion to a new world order of dialogue. Terry O'Reilly will be exploring that shift in a new show, Under the Influence. Coming in January, visit cbc.ca/under the influence.
It's Wednesday, December 28th. Even as sectarian violence and political turmoil escalate, the U.S. remains firm. Its troops will not return to Iraq. Currently, Washington says, if only you guys really had weapons of mass destruction, maybe then we could have kept this thing going. This is The Current Podcast.
Good morning and welcome to The Current. I'm Pia Chattopadhyay, sitting in for Anna Maria Tremonti. This morning, as Kim Jong-il is laid to rest, protesters are on the streets of Seoul, condemning their northern neighbor's regime. Some factory workers in China have walked off the job, demanding higher wages. In India, an anti-corruption activist is on a hunger strike. From the Arab Street to Wall Street and so many places in between, the bellow of 2011 is ringing out loud and clear. Ordinary citizens chanting for change, prodding and provoking power brokers the world over. We're talking protest in our first half hour.
Allahu Akbar! Allahu Akbar! Thank you very much! Thank you!
Alhamdulillah, Lina, Alhamdulillah.
People are just celebrating what happened. They are anxious for freedom and they are free now. They are just saying we are free at last.
If you're a regular listener to The Current, those sounds are familiar. Howls of protests from around the world against inequality, against corruption, against tyranny. Almost every country in the Arab world felt the fury of its citizens this year, and a bloody crackdown continues in Syria. Occupy Wall Street protesters were directly inspired by the Egyptian occupation of Tahrir Square, and the Occupy idea spread throughout North America. In Europe, austerity measures brought people out in angry crowds. In Russia, the streets filled with people enraged with what they believed to be election fraud. Protesters froze the XL pipeline, and Chinese farmers confronted police for 2 weeks over some confiscated land. Revolution may not be in the air, but revolt sure is. So when writer Kurt Anderson went looking for Time magazine's Person of the Year, the protester topped the list. Here's why.
Protest has sort of fallen out of fashion the last 20 years. When you and I were young, whether it was civil rights protests, anti-Vietnam protests, they were news and they were a big deal. That, in the last couple of decades, hasn't been so much the case. Not only did protest come back in this big, globally contagious way this year, but you know, we are two regimes down and counting. I mean, there's this incredible effect that makes it the biggest deal in more than a century in terms of this global sense of protesting against governments that are perceived as corrupt and ineffectual, and then the consequence flowing from that.
That's Time magazine's Kurt Anderson. Occupy Wall Street protester Jonathan Smucker is in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Good morning.
Good morning.
How much do you agree with Time magazine's view that 2011 was the year of the protester?
I think it's a fun kind of thing to play with. I think that the term protester is somewhat problematic. I don't consider myself a protester. I'm a small business person who has joined a protest because protest is one of the many means that we have available to us when our governments aren't representing us to engage in civically. And so it's not about a kind of person. It's about a revitalization of the civic sphere to me.
But the reality is you were one of the many people around the world who went out on the streets and fought against the power brokers.
Absolutely. And I'm still in New York, except I'm home for the holidays, but still in New York, engaged in this way. And when I say it's one of the means, right now we're having lots of meetings planning our next step. There's steps, there's a lot of activity besides just the most visible dramatic stuff that you see.
You know, protests took the world by storm this year. We can debate the term, but they certainly did, from Cairo to Calgary. Why do you think protesting on the streets and public squares gained so much traction?
I think that it's something that's been missing in the United States, at least. I can speak to our context and our culture. I think it's something that we've been missing a lot of. That is that civic sphere. And that combined with, you know, the nosedive that our economy took, a lot of blame for Wall Street, big banks, the financial sector that is perceived and I believe really drove our economy into a ditch. And that once we've kind of come out of our, you know, looking at those economic conditions and our prospects graduating from college, our mounting household debt, foreclosed homes, et cetera, we realize that some of the same forces have really corrupted our democracy to the point where our leaders aren't listening to us. And that's a lot of what protest is. It's a cry out for things to change.
You mentioned that the movement you're part of, Occupy, you know, you're out of public squares and off the streets for now, but you say it will continue. Do you think that this so-called global awakening, where will it go from here?
Well, I wish I could tell the future. Honestly, I didn't see this coming quite so soon. I think a lot of people didn't. But I do think that you are going to see expressions of it this next year in the United States with the election season, but not just around the elections. I think it's going to continue to be an outside force that pulls the whole national dialogue. I think one form that's taking in the United States, people are starting to get organized to defend people staying in their homes. We're saying we bailed out these banks, and then they went on to foreclose on millions of American families. We can do better than that, and we're going to make sure that happens. That's one form. I know that there will continue to be protests in the street. In the streets and, you know, around the world, I think you're going to see corrective action, which is what protest is, until there's a significant correction of course. And I think that's going to take a long time, really, because we're up against a lot of entrenched power systems. And that's why folks are coming out into the street now.
Okay, Jonathan Smucker, thank you for your time this morning.
Hey, thank you.
Jonathan Smucker is an Occupy Wall Street protester. He's in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Well, in Russia, protests over alleged election fraud are still gaining momentum. An estimated 60 to 100,000 people attended a protest in Moscow last Saturday. Russia hasn't seen that type of public display of anger in more than 20 years. Alexei Korolov is a protester and journalist, and he's in Moscow. Hello.
Hello. Hi.
What can you tell me about last Saturday's protests?
It was really great. I mean, it was a lot bigger than the previous one on the 10th of December. But to me, it lacked a certain sense of unity, really, because there was a lot of nationalist among the crowd. And also, you know, the crowd was quite disparate, but it still retained a sort of a sense of a communal effort.
And the common goal is what?
You know, we're all demanding a rerun of the elections. And also, and this is something that we're now starting to focus on, we demand the ouster of Prime Minister Vladimir Putin.
Russia hasn't seen this kind of demonstration and these kinds of numbers for two decades. Are you surprised at how many people are turning out?
I really am. I really am surprised. The whole thing sort of happened overnight, really. I mean, the first post-election protest on the 5th of December, it was sanctioned, so everybody knew about it in advance. And I thought that it would draw 1,000 or 2,000 people at most, you know, at the very most, and it drew about 5,000 or 6,000 people. Facebook and social media, I think, play a big role in this.
Why do you think people are taking their anger and frustration to the streets now?
Well, anti-government sentiment in Russia, I think, has been building for quite some time now. You know, people have seen so many cases and reports of electoral fraud so many clips, you know, video footages and photos and other reports have been uploaded to social media, and people now have full access to that. So the prevailing sense now in Moscow and in St. Petersburg and in many other large cities in Russia is that the authorities are cheating people, and people are not going to take that anymore.
And to what extent do you think the people on the streets in Russia are being influenced, at least, you know, in spirit, by the protests that we've seen in so many other places this year?
I think the Arab Spring has played a part in this, really. The anger at authorities, and, you know, specifically at Vladimir Putin, is now so huge in Russia. Further protests have been now planned for after the New Year holidays, end of January and February and March. And I think this sort of thing is going to sustain, is going to continue. The protest movement is going to draw more people.
And how would you define what a successful outcome will be in the protest movement?
Obviously, the successful outcome would be a rerun of the elections.
And short of that?
You know, the ouster of Vladimir Putin and the wholesale change of the political system in Russia.
And do you think that's a realistic goal?
Certain things are changing now. We can see that a wholesale shuffle going on now within the Kremlin. So I think that's a clear sign that the authorities are sort of taking note of the protests. And Putin and Medvedev have spoken out on a number of occasions about the protests. They've been dismissing them, and they've been dismissing protesters as, you know, paid agents of the West and everything. But it is clear that they see that, they understand the demands, and that they're going to do something about it.
Alexei Korolev, thank you.
Thanks.
Alexei Korolev is a protester and journalist. He's in Moscow. So why do some ideas bring people out of their homes and into the streets to confront such huge odds? Why do some protests wither while others gain momentum? I'm joined now by Dominic Clement. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Alberta and the author of Canada's Rights Revolution, Social Movements and Social Change, 1937 to 1982. He's in Edmonton this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
To your mind, how significant have the mass street protests and protesters of 2011 really been?
Oh, there's no question that it's been a significant year, although, of course, in Canada, not too recently, we had the G20 protests, which garnered a great deal of attention as well. But certainly the widespread nature of the protests and the size and scale of them in North America, from New York across Canada, the Arab Spring, you're mentioning Russia, and, of course, there's all the protests going on in Greece and Western Europe over the economic conditions, protests in places far away as South Korea and China. Certainly the scale of these kind of protests is certainly unique to 2011. Although whether or not it's as large as what we kind of saw in the 1960s, that might be a bit questionable. But certainly in the past decade, I think we have seen a very unique phenomenon this year.
You know, there's the cliche that timing is everything. What is it about 2011 or the confluence of events that made it happen all this year?
You know, it's funny because when try to explain the emergence of protests, there's a whole bunch of things that come together, but often it could be something as simple as a trigger event or a symbol or an idea that kind of catches along. So it's people going to a park in New York City and inspiring a large number of other people going. A trigger event like that can be all you need to get a protest going. There in Tunisia, for example, there was a case of the man who immolated himself after being abused by state authorities. So sometimes it can be simply a trigger event that leads people to get on the streets. But another really critical issue is the way in which you frame your protest, the way in which you frame the issue. I often like to use the example of the environmental movement. Environmentalists present the issue as simply a question of environmental degradation will only mobilize a certain sector of the community. But if you also present it, as we did in Clayquot Sound, for instance, as not just about the environment, but also about Aboriginal land, for instance, well, then you kind of expand the scope and the interest of the issue. And then if you start talking about workers, it expands the motivation of the issue as well. So the way you frame an issue, it changes all the way in which you're able to appeal to a larger group, and it makes the movement that much more sustainable.
So when I think of the message of the Arab Spring, I mean, to get rid of a dictator, that seems more of a tangible goal or a clearer message than the more nuanced message of Occupy, let's say. Is that what you're saying there, that one needs to have a clear message in order to be successful?
One needs to have a clear message, but also one needs to have an inspiring message as well. I actually think the Occupy protests are extraordinarily successful, and one of the reasons they are, when they think, keep in mind, of Occupy is just not out of nowhere, right? Now, these issues and concerns, I mean, the G20 protests in Canada, for instance, were in many ways about the same issues, about poverty and inequality. What I think one of the things that made Occupy so effective is that slogan, "We are the 99%. Now, there is a great way to frame an issue that appeals to almost everybody, well, except for the 1%, of course, right? So that would be a great example of framing an issue in a way that appeals to a broad sector of the community. And I think it helps explain why something that began in New York had widespread appeal, not just United States, but across the world as well.
You mentioned that there needs to be a trigger and a good articulation of a message. But I'm wondering, how does a person make the decision to go from a regular Joe citizen to a protester who actually gets up off the couch and takes to the street or the public square?
Well, I think that question really gets to the heart of why this year is so significant. Although they might not do it consciously, most people who protest, well, I'd say old people who protest, do a kind of cost-benefit analysis. They won't maybe do it consciously, but they'll always be aware of the cost involved in doing a protest. So in a place like New York or Edmonton, for instance, the cost is low. I mean, certainly with the G20 protests, we saw that the cost could be high. You might get arrested. You might get harmed. But generally in North America, Western Europe, the costs are low. But imagine the costs involved in an individual, a shop owner, a student in a place like Tunisia and Libya, even in Russia. The costs are very high. The danger to somebody could be extraordinarily high of getting hurt, harmed, even killed, as we've seen in certain circumstances. So it's, people are motivated or understand this kind of cost-benefit approach. And so it just goes to show how remarkable this year was in that all these people are willing to go out in the streets and risk their lives for an issue that they believe in.
The media has done umpteen stories this year about the role of social media and its relationship to protests. How significant do you think social media is in spurring modern-day protests?
Well, I don't want to underestimate the importance of social media. It is significant, as technology always is, but I think we need to remember that social movements and social protests date back to 18th century in England and Western Europe, and they spread throughout the Western world by the 19th century. So people were protesting and doing the same things they're doing now long before even the existence of the telephone or even large-scale mail systems. But certainly social media seems to have played a role in terms of spreading the issue, spreading the message functionally. I think probably its most important function is not so much in the local, but it's in the transnational. You know, we never had international social movements before the 1970s. They're really kind of a modern phenomena. And I think technology has spurred the internationalization, the globalization of social protests. So I think that's what's really key. Of course, social media plays an important role in repressive regimes, but I think it helps give a global context because it spreads the message so widely in a way you've never really seen before the 21st century.
And spreads the inspiration, perhaps, as we heard our guest in Russia say.
Absolutely. You know, it's funny, one of the things that made the 1960s so important, we never really talk about it, but it's something as simple as television. You know, televisions weren't really in every American or Canadian house really until the 1960s, really pervasive. And what they did was they brought police abuse of civil rights protesters, or in Canada, police abuse of protesters, into everybody's living room in a very personal way. And I think that's what social media, things like YouTube, is helping do, is it's bringing to those of us who perhaps can't relate to these things on a direct level, it brings in a very personal way to our own experience and helps expand support for a particular movement.
When I think back to the 60s and 70s and the big protests of those days, I think a lot about religious groups or other social institutions playing such a critical role in those protests. Are those still relevant today?
It's hard to say. It often depends on the context. You're absolutely right that we often overlook the role that religion and churches play. And sometimes it's something just as simple as providing a physical place for people to meet, providing the resources, you know, food, snacks, volunteer help. That is absolutely central, the nuts and bolts of a protest movement. Churches don't, like organized labor, churches don't play as much of a leading role as they used to do. I think the reason for that is we've seen only since the 1960s a proliferation of what we call kind of professional social movement organizations, Greenpeace, Sierra Club, organizations like this that didn't exist before the 60s. And they're taking more of the lead. And so churches as an institution are stepping back. But let's never forget the crucial role they play still in North America, but also outside of North America as well. In repressive regimes where you're not allowed to form the kind of groups that we take for granted every day, a church is a place where you can gather and it's legitimate, it has a moral voice. So churches play a crucial role, especially in the Middle East, but South America and other parts around the world. I'm sure Russia, it's a factor as well. They make it possible. We saw them in Poland, absolutely, in the late 1980s. They play a crucial role in help facilitating social protests. So perhaps not as important today in North America and Canada, but I think very important in repressive regimes.
What about the criticism that this is a minority of people who don't necessarily speak on behalf of the broader public? We even heard that in the early days of the Arab Spring in Egypt, that people were saying, well, those are just the kids that go down to Tahrir Square. Is that a criticism that this is just a small number of people that aren't representing me?
I get that comment, the question all the time, and I understand where it's coming from, but I would disagree. It's not at all for two reasons. One, it's not a surprise that youth are pervasive in these kind of visible protests. If you think about it, youth have more time, they have more flexibility in their schedules, they have less responsibilities, they generally tend to be more liberal or open-minded, and they're, of course, more directly affected by these issues. Think of the unemployment rate for youth in not only Middle East, but Western countries as well. So it's not surprising that youth tend to play a core role, that simply they're well situated to do so. But to say that they are a small group, authorities often like to present protesters this way. It makes them seem outside the mainstream. In fact, you never have a protest like you've been seeing all across the world unless there's some kind of underlying grievance. The reality is that the scale of these things makes it impossible to be a small group of people who know each other. In fact, they're quite expansive. They're very representative. So you have to ask yourself, what is it that's bringing all these people from across a country who've never met each other, who don't know each other, have nothing in common, what is bringing them together? And in fact, it has to be some kind of underlying grievance, poverty, inequality, democracy, issues like this. So I think it's the idea that it's a minority of people who go around protesting and that they all have things in common. I think this is more the way authorities like to present the issue because, of course, that makes it easier to justify repressing or limiting their rights to free speech.
Okay, Dominic Clement, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dominic Clement is an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Alberta. He's in Edmonton.
Looking for more CBC podcasts? Go to cbc.ca/podcasting.